Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Amanda Carrasco. Amanda Carrasco is a family survivor of homicide and sexual assault who uses her experiences to impact the lives of her community and those impacted by the justice system. She is a successful global business owner, dynamic speaker, consultant, and leader who values community and justice. Amanda brings an opportunity to break the cycle of harm and restore our sense of belonging. Restorative justice is the core of her practice, and she is a certified facilitator through the Restorative Justice Council. She holds 4 master's degrees from multiple nations, 2 of them in law, a powerful advocate, survivor, and storyteller who believes in the power of truth, healing, and transformation. Amanda, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today.
Thanks, Dave, for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And we met through a very competent book agent, or, you know, book publicist, Angele Barbazon from Book World. And she had introduced me to a previous client of hers that thought it'd be a good fit for the Teaching Journeys podcast. And I said, look, I had such a good experience with this person. If you have anybody else that you think would be a good fit for the podcast, let me know. And lo and behold, she introduced me to you. We had a pre-chat. A great time during the pre-chat, and here we are today.
Yeah, it's helpful. I mean, you got to have a good team, right? Whatever your team looks like. And so Angele's amazing. She's from Books Forward, by the way, that's her company. And yeah, she's phenomenal just in terms of connecting. And because it's great to have a story, but then how do you bring that story out to people so they know it? So it's helpful. I'm so appreciative for people that are helping to get the story out. And she is one of them.
Yeah, she strikes me as being very competent as to what she does and how she does it. She pays attention to detail, which impresses me. So I guess I have some questions for you, and I know you probably got some answers for me, so I guess we might as well get going.
I'll do my best.
Oh, I have no doubt, Amanda, that you will do more than your best. So, but first of all, tell our audience about the experiences that have shaped your path as an advocate for restorative justice.
Right. I appreciate you read that lengthy introduction. You know, it covers a lot of ground because there's a lot of ground to cover. Mm. Obviously, specifically, it starts, you know, with sort of the origin story, which is, you know, your childhood experiences, your growing up, because, you know, those really are your formative years and they have some deep impact for you. And so that was true for me. And unfortunately, my childhood was marked with a lot of harm. So I do have, you know, working with complex trauma, PTSD kind of a thing. I experienced multiple sexual assaults from different people, multiple occurrences from the same people. And then I'm a family survivor of homicide because my sister and her children were murdered when I was 16 years old and living with them and was supposed to be home, but had had an argument with her. And that's the only reason why I'm here today.
Yeah, I remember that part of the story very vividly. And you mentioned in the book, in your book, which we're going to be talking about, Becoming the Brave One, My Journey to Justice, you mentioned in the book that you should have been there. But obviously the universe had a greater plan for you and you weren't supposed to be there.
Yeah, it's a hard one though. Like there's definitely, I mean, survivor's guilt is a very real thing, you know, having to deal with the fact that she's gone and I'm not, and wishing that it could have been reversed. Like my sister was a light to me. I mean, I had all of this darkness around me. She was trying to help me. She was supporting me. She saw me. She was taking care of me. Like she was my legal guardian at that point. And so she was kind of everything. I looked up to her, my role model. And so to have her life taken just kind of threw me into a super, super dark state. But it just kind of, it was so hard because it's like, but why her? Like, she's so great. She should be here and I should not. If anybody's going to go, it should have been me. So yeah, that's been a lifelong sort of thread to carry and navigate through.
Yeah, and survival guilt's been a big part of my journey as far as with my losses too. I question even sometimes today, why did I get the privilege to grow older while others didn't?
Yeah.
And that's not an answer, any human lie answer I have. I couldn't even give you a human lie answer for that. It's just, it's beyond human law comprehension. But the fact of the matter is we're here. We've been given the opportunity to serve, and I believe we might as well make the best of it and try to leave some positive tracks before it is our turn to dance into another dimension with those that have gone before us.
Yeah.
So tell our audience about restorative justice. I know this was a big part for you personally in terms of your journey. What is it? How does it work? And how did it help you address your personal trauma specifically?
Restorative justice is something that certainly is misunderstood a lot. And so I think that it's important that people do have a good concept of what it is and what it isn't. It really is about putting the victim back into the center of what happened and asking exactly who was harmed, how did that come to be, and what are their needs now? And so that's the restorative piece of that. We currently live in an adversarial system, whether it's in the justice system or even just how we deal with conflict. So restorative justice says, look, we can be harmed in community and we need to heal in community. We need to be together and the victim needs to be the driver, because I can't assume to know what your needs are and you shouldn't assume to know what mine are. So having a victim-led process is really integral and foundational to the healing journey. So for me, I had two restorative justice opportunities. The first was very informal, and it was before I even knew what restorative justice was. So one of the people who harmed me in terms of my sexual assaults was a family member. And so I had initiated a conversation with him. I had gone through another family member and said, hey, like, would he be willing to sit and talk with me? Because I have questions. There were some gaps in my memory. There were some things I just didn't understand. And I wanted to ask. And the only person that would have those answers was him. So that's very common among victims, that we have questions, that the person who harmed you is the only one with those answers. So that can be a really important piece of our healing to get some answers. So he agreed to meet with me and we sat, just the two of us. I was in my early 20s. Whenever I tell this story, I always strongly caution people, please be very careful. I would recommend, there's amazing restorative justice organizations, groups, facilitators that can help you with this journey. Because if the person's not willing to take responsibility or, you know, really address the harm, like, this could have more harm. So we've got to be careful, again, like, what restorative justice is. It's a place that's safe for all parties. And it's a place for healing, not further harm, not further weaponizing or further abuse or beratement or denial or anything like that. That's not what this is. So I took this initiative, though, and I sat with him. And so I got a lot of the answers that I was looking for, and it really helped me significantly in terms of that piece. I still had residual, like, when you've been sexually assaulted, there's a lot of things that still carry with you. And so I still had to deal with those outside of him, but that's what therapy's for, a great circle of friends that you can talk to and be open with and all those kinds of things. But he gave me a significant piece, and I'm really, really grateful for that piece. And so we do have what I would call a restored relationship. There's still very healthy boundaries, because I'll still have triggers and things like that at times. So it's not just like, oh, everything is fine and we pretend like nothing happened. No, not at all. But there is a restoration to a place that is healthy in that relationship. And I know that he's not harming anyone else. I know the journey that he went through and his experiences. And so that was really helpful for me as well. And then 3 years ago, I initiated a restorative justice process with the man who murdered my family. Now, back up, you know, I think about 2 years before that was when I started really learning about restorative justice and what it was. And the man who murdered my family, he did go to prison, and I had a caseworker because I'm a registered victim of the crime. And I had mentioned to her that I was learning all about restorative justice and what a neat concept it was. And she said, yeah, but that could apply to you. Like, if you wanted a restorative justice process with your offender, we could arrange that. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's nice. But no, thank you. No. Like, no, I don't want to be anywhere near that man. And so we ended up, though, 2 years down the road, I had been working with incarcerated individuals at that point and seeing some of the transformations that are possible. And I know that the man who murdered my family isn't in that space, but just to even know and see that that's possible brought so much freedom to me. And I'm so grateful for my community in California that are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated men that I've had the honor and privilege to get to know, and they share their stories with me. I've been able to be a surrogate victim for some of them and express to them some of the pieces, you know, what this looks like from the victim side, because, I mean, they don't know some of it either. So that's been an incredible experience. And so that led me to the point where I came and decided, yes, I think I do want to sit down with him. I think that I have needs that would be met by having this circle. So it was 2 years from the time I kind of decided, okay, I think I want to do this, to the actual meeting. So that was a long piece. He didn't get as much lead up. He only got a week's notice. My restorative justice caseworker went to him and said, Amanda would like to meet with you. Are you interested? And he said, yeah, I'm familiar with restorative justice. I would like to do that. And he said, great. She's going to be here next week. And he went, oh, I thought it takes like years. And he's like, well, would you like to meet next week? Because that's the option. And he said, yes. So I went and I sat with him, and I had prepared in advance what it was that I needed to say to him, the questions that I needed to ask. And for me, there actually weren't a ton of questions that I needed to ask him because we had gone to trial. I had testified at the preliminary hearing and at the trial, you know, back when I was like 16, 17 years old, 16 when it happened, 17 at the trial and trying to graduate high school and testifying my sister's murder trial. And so I really more had a need to share with him the pain, because when you lose a family member to murder, it's just so horrific and so unjust. This should not have happened. This was someone's choice or recklessness, whatever it was. In this case, having that be a family member, it was her husband, someone who was supposed to love us, protect us, work for us all our lives and betterment. And we lived together and I loved him and I thought he loved us. So it adds a level of betrayal when the person that murdered your loved one was part of the family. So sitting down and being able to explain to him the harm that he's left me with, that I will carry for the rest of my life, because you can't fix this. She's not coming back. The babies are not coming back. Having to carry that on and what that looks like for me. And it was like I almost sort of broke off a piece of my pain and like handed it to him and said, here, this is yours. Like, I can't give you all of this. I wish I could, but I can give you a piece of it because you're the person that gave this to me. And you could see him, you know, almost sort of physically take it in. Like, there was the change in his demeanor, the way his body moved. And so that was really helpful to me, that I knew that he now knew what he had done, like how he had harmed.
So was that the goal for you, to let him know how his actions affected you? Or was there more to it that you were looking to accomplish?
That was honestly my number one goal for me personally. And like I said, because a lot of questions had been asked and answered, like a lot of people ask why. I knew why. I knew why he had planned this. You know, I knew the influences. I knew all of those pieces. So that wasn't outstanding for me. It was more that I just needed him to know what he did, you know, and how much it hurt, how much this has affected all of us, the entire family, for the rest of our lives. You know, we are carrying this forever and you did it. So that was definitely my number one goal, was that. But then, as kind of happens with restorative justice, there's other pieces that come, you know, sort of organically and naturally. He gave me some of my memories back. There were things I'd forgotten about my sister, and they're little things, but they're significant. You know, he said, do you remember that, you know, she would never let us say no to the babies. She would say, you have to say, please don't. And I mean, it was ridiculous. Like, but that was my sister. You know, she didn't say no. She said, please don't. And I mean, it drove everybody crazy. But that was so her. And it was just her heart of how to like nurture her children to the best of her abilities. And that was what she believed. And I had forgotten that. And that was a powerful moment, like to remember something about her that I had forgotten, you know? So there were some other really great things that came out of it. I lost a lot of fear too. I should say that, you know, because I was always afraid. I mean, this man was going to kill me. Had I not had that argument with my sister, like it was planned, it was premeditated. It wasn't like he snapped. He wanted us all dead. So this man was prepared to take my life too. And it's only by her being protective and we getting into a fight because I was being a bratty teenager. And then I got mad at her. And so it's only because of that that I'm here. So I carried this fear and then testifying against him, you know. So I thought there's a possibility he's going to get out of jail one day and he'll come for me. And one of his family members even said that to my biological mom. He's going to get out. He's coming for her. And it was like, what the? So I said that to him. I said, we need to talk about this. Like, this is what your family member said. And, you know, so we talked it through and he just said to the man, like, that's not true. I'm not angry at you. I understand. I'm not angry. And he's obviously not a person that I would trust, but it felt genuine. And I think the whole process of being able to sort of stand up to him and tell him and use my voice and say, you did this and this is how you harmed me. It gave me some power back. And just to see when I walked into the room and he was shaking, but to be like, oh, he's actually afraid of me. I have some power. I have some effect on this man. So that I walked out of there and was re-traumatized. So it took a while to go through. But once I got through that, I was so much more free. I had less fear. I carried less pain. Like it was a whole different world, you know, after, you know, like about took me about 3 weeks to kind of come down off of that whole piece. Yeah.
Well, for me, when you were describing the process of restorative justice, it puts the power back into the hands of the victim. It's a very empowering process from what it sounds like to me, is that where the victim in a safe environment has an opportunity to confront perpetrator, or in this case, the person who took your sister's and her children's lives, and be able to have a conversation about that, let him know how you felt. Also, you know, talk about some additional fears you had about him coming after you again in a safe environment. And it sounded like, I don't know if the term healing is the right term or the appropriate term, but it sounded incredibly empowering and maybe liberating in some ways.
Yeah, I would absolutely say that. I did. I felt freer, you know, than I was before. You know, some of the symptoms, like something can fall in my house now and I'm not on the ceiling. You know, like my body used to freak out when I heard a noise that I didn't know. It automatically would assume he's here, he's coming for you. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, logically, like, he's in a prison, you know, thousands of miles away, but it didn't matter to my body. He's here coming for you because there's a noise you didn't know what it was.
Yep.
So yeah, to have that was huge for me.
Yeah, particular, you know, cues such as noises, you know, sudden movements, sounds, seeing somebody in the environment that reminds you of the perpetrator of abuse or the perpetrator of a violent crime. That's a trigger for the re-experiencing of PTSD symptoms and trauma anyway. We talked prior to recording about the scientific benefits that have been proven with restorative justice. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because science does prove that there is a benefit physically in our bodies, our brain, to restorative justice. So can you just speak a little bit on that for us, Amanda?
I definitely can. There's so many benefits to restorative justice that are proven with data and with facts. And I feel one of the reasons why I wrote my story, reason why I'm going on podcasts, talking and speaking anywhere and everywhere that I can, is because people need to know them. I think that that's really important because we don't really understand how deep of a healing and impact that this has. So, you know, and I feel like I'm uniquely in a position where I've got the background, like you said, like I've got 2 master's degrees in law, restorative justice certificate. My dissertation on one of those was restorative justice law reform in England. Like I've studied this, but it was also a part of my life. Like I've lived it. So I can talk about research and data, but you can also look at me and see this is a living human person and put meat on the bones of the research. So, but the research is out there in terms of symptoms of PTSD and things that people are experiencing with the nightmares, the triggers, sleeplessness, like so much anxiety, panic, all of that. And then so testing them before they go in and seeing what level those symptoms are at, and then going back and doing a reevaluation after the circle process and seeing where they are there. And there's just such a significant gap between the two.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's even in other cases, I've quoted Bessel van der Kolk's research on individuals that he's worked with who he basically talked about his, you know, with trauma, that some individuals, they'll tell you they can't speak about the trauma, you know, that they have no words. And it's because scientifically his research has proven that the part of the brain shuts down that allows us to verbalize that trauma. And I think that's the left side of the brain. So anything that we can do, I think, with restorative justice processes or other similarly empowering processes to restore that kind of body health or brain health or physicality or physical health, I think is key. And I think if we're physically healthy, that relates to how we think, how we, you know, we look at the world and, you know, our emotions as well, too. So I think anything that can restore that, I think, is key.
Well, and I think it's really important for people to understand, too, that one of the many beautiful things about restorative justice is that, like, for me, my experience happened, you know, 28 years after the loss of my sister. But it can happen anywhere in the process.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can happen before any kind of police intervention or involvement. It can happen after. It can happen before sentencing. You know, Community Justice Initiatives in Langley has a new program, which is called Collaborative Sentencing. And so they're working with prosecutors and defense attorneys, where the defense attorney has a client who wants to plead guilty, and they bring the victim and the defendant together in a circle process, and they decide the sentence together on a plan. It's presented to the judge. And so, of course, a judge always has the final say. But in every single case that they've worked on, the judge has sentenced exactly according to the sentencing plan. So it's really involving the victim in the process. And I think that we're going to see a lessening of the trauma from some of these circumstances because they're a part of the process. Mm-hmm. You know, in our current system, you are a witness to your own crime. You are at the beck and call of the prosecution. You do what they tell you to do, when and how they tell you to do it. They are in control. You are not in control, even though this happened to you. So these types of programs, I think, are incredible in terms of accountability, because you have to sit with the person you harmed. You have to face them. You have to deal with that. And then you're working together for how do we move forward out of this? What does this look like? And we're not talking about cases of stolen bikes. The cases that they dealt with are cases where one involved a murder, another one involved a defendant who was a police officer who committed harm while on the job. His whole entire career was on the line. Like, these are very serious cases and ramifications, and we're finding the outcomes are so beneficial for all parties.
Yeah, I would think it would be, because, again, you're creating a community of healing, of accountability. I think that involves everybody, and I think it needs to be beneficial to everybody who's involved, perpetrator, the victim, everybody. And I think it's a good alternative, or even to some of the rehabilitative practices we have in the criminal justice system. I used to be a probation officer in the Stop DWI program way back in the 80s in my local county, and I had a very visionary director who said, I don't want you putting individuals with alcohol problems. I don't want you recommending jail sentences. I want you to recommend treatment. I want you to recommend rehab. We want to be able to give them the resources so they can become productive citizens again. And I think there's the restorative justice, I think, would be something that I think would be probably a better alternative than some of the rehabilitative practices we have in the criminal justice system. And like you said, with the prosecution, they call the shots, they set the plea bargain arrangements, and it's very disempowering, particularly if you're talking about an individual who's been a victim of a perpetrator's crime. They have no say.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah.
So tell me about the preparation. You're a surrogate, correct, for the restorative justice process. What does that involve? What do you do as a surrogate? How does that work in terms of the restorative justice process?
I love restorative justice so much because it's so adaptable. You know, that's the thing. Like, our current system is a one size fits all. You know, this is how we handle these things. This is how we move forward. Whereas restorative justice is flexible and meet the needs. So this is a situation where it might not be safe to meet with the person who harmed you, or it might not, you know, you might not be able to, you know, like for the majority of offenders, they're not allowed to contact their victims, right? They want to make amends. They want to say sorry. They want to be held accountable. There actually is a significant number of them. Like, I've worked with men that have harmed in huge ways, rapes and murders. So this is really important. But again, it has to be victim driven and it should be voluntary. You should not be forcing people into these situations. Yep. So if a victim's not willing to come forward, or like I say, it's not safe for a victim to meet with an offender, that's where we look at that surrogacy piece. So because I'm a family survivor of homicide, because I'm a survivor of sexual assault, I've been able to use my experiences and then relay to the offenders what that's looked like for me. We talk through the different effects in my life, the missed birthdays, the missed graduations, all those types of things, how it's impacted me personally, my relationships with other people, all that kind of stuff. And so then it can also work the other way too, where if you have a victim, you can talk to others. And that's where I say my work with incarcerated people has benefited me, because it's like they've also been surrogates for me. Because the man who murdered my sister does not take full responsibility and accountability. He's not there yet. I don't know if he ever will be. I really don't. I would hope so. I do hope that. But we're not there. And I did talk to him about that, that like, if you ever get there, it would be really helpful to the family. But mm-hmm. that's a choice that you have to make. I know what the inhibitors are, but that's your call. But I just need you to know that like, you're still continuing to harm by not being fully accountable. So to see men who have committed harms, whether it's domestic violence, there's several that have committed murders in various capacities, and, you know, being able to talk with them and see them take responsibility. I volunteered for a number of years with an organization called CROP, and it was started by four amazing men in Soledad Prison in California. These are guys that incredibly transformed their lives and their incarcerated community, and now are out in the community doing incredible things. And I remember the first time that I ever met Jason Bryant and Ted Gray, we were all in a Zoom together, and I knew the backgrounds and stories of these people. So I knew that Jason Bryant was not even in the room where the person was killed, that he was sort of a part of. And I knew that Ted did not pull the trigger on the person who was murdered. And both of them, as we went around and introduced ourselves and, you know, our connections to the justice system and experiences, both of those men said, "I killed someone." And it just, that stuck with me so deeply, of how much they were taking responsibility for their contribution to the death of that man. Even though I knew they, neither of those men pulled the trigger. Jay wasn't even in the room, and they both started the same way. And that just stayed with me so deeply. So for me as a victim to be with people that are taking accountability, it was super healing to me. So they were like my surrogates that I, you know, I needed an offender to say like, "Hey, I did wrong here and I'm owning it." And they've taught me, like, even if your contribution was 10%, you own 100% of that 10%. Yep. And I've loved that. That's always stuck with me when I'm looking at, when I screw up and make mistakes, I'm like, ah, crap. I know I'd like to minimize it. I'd like to excuse it away, but I need to own 100% of my 10%. Those guys taught me that.
Well, and I think accountability in any setting is just a powerful tool to, one, it just keeps us human. And it also, I think, helps us build relationships because, you know, we're willing to share that vulnerability that, hey, we made mistakes. For me, I never hesitated being accountable to a client when I screwed up. You know, if I wanted to build a therapeutic relationship with them, they had to see that, yeah, if I wanted accountability from them, they had to see that I was willing to be accountable to them as well. Right. And I think that one term said, "Hey, I did this. I have no excuse for this. I did this. I was wrong." And I like that 100, you know, if you did 10% of it, own 100% of that 10%. Own your part with that. Don't blame anybody else. You own the part of what you did, and let everybody else take responsibility as to the extent that they wish to for what they did. But we have control over how we see our own reality and how we choose to be accountable within our own reality.
Yeah, it's true. And it's not just the big things. It's not just, murders. Like, it's the little things, the ways you screw up with your kids and you lose your cool and yell at them or make a mistake at work or whatever it is, owning our stuff. And like you say, like being transparent, being held accountable. Every single one of us need that in our lives. And so as I say, like, it's helped me be a better person from learning, all of these principles and ways of doing life that are super healthy. Yeah. They're hard. It's hard, to be like, oh my gosh, I royally dropped the ball here.
Yeah.
But it's better.
Well, I think particularly depending on our histories, depending on our family histories, that type of accountability can be really scary too. For a lot of different reasons.
Right.
Because a lot of times, and I've talked to individuals who've come from unhealthy families, if they were accountable, it was either not validated or it was violently addressed.
Right.
And so they learned sometimes that it was better to in their best interest for survival to lie rather than tell the truth or to be accountable as a survival mechanism. So, but I think being accountable can also illustrate that we can also be vulnerable and not be punished for it.
Right. But we do have to accept that there's consequences and there's a difference between punishment and consequences. Because I've seen that too, where someone goes, oh, I screwed this up. I'm really sorry this happened. And it's like, okay, well, now we need to hold you accountable. And like, these are the repercussions. And it's like, no, but like I told you. Yeah, we need to take measures. So I kind of talk about that in my book. There's been a couple of experiences, in terms of leadership and particularly in the church where we've kind of really dropped the ball there. Someone comes forward and they're like, oh, I'm so sorry. I messed this up. I'm repentant. And we're like, oh, we forgive you. Stay in your role. Everything is okay. No, it's not okay. You kissed a teenage girl and you're the youth pastor. You should not be the youth pastor anymore. I'm sorry. There's consequences to those actions. It doesn't mean that we don't love and accept you as a person. We appreciate that. Truth is important. But, it's not a punishment. It's a logical thing because, obviously there's some stuff we need to deal with here. We can't just keep you in that same role and be like, no big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's one thing I was going to wanted to ask you, just that this came to me when you mentioned the term forgiveness, and I'm new to restorative justice, so I'm kind of like the student here, and I'm putting you in the position of teacher. What does restorative justice, if anything, what can this teach us about forgiveness? First of all, is forgiveness necessarily a part of the process of restorative justice? And what also can restorative justice teach us about developing empathy for others?
So I think there's a huge focus on empathy. I think that forgiveness happens frequently. It's a term that I struggle with, to be honest, because like I kind of alluded to, that we, in a lot of ways, in a lot of contexts, we're kind of told like, okay, well, just forgive and move on. Forgive and forget, those types of things. And, when we're trying to hold someone accountable, that other people are like, it's no big deal. And they're really kind of invalidating. They weaponize it and use it against you. Like, oh, you just should forgive. So I struggle with the concept of forgiveness in terms of the way that we've seen it used. I do think it's important. And yeah, it definitely is a byproduct of restorative justice. We see that a lot. But I think that goes back to that empathy piece. Empathy is critical. To be able to put yourself in the position of the other person is fundamental in terms of rehabilitation and stopping recidivism. Because when you can understand how you're hurting people, and because we've all been hurt, right? So when you can relate, I'm making that person feel that way and I've hurt that way. I get that. So I know I've talked with someone that said, like, I saw my victim and I was victimized. And when I realized that's what I was doing to them, that's what helped them stop. So that empathy piece is critical. And we develop that. Like, that's absolutely a piece of restorative justice that comes. That is fundamental. It really is just organic. It's part of the whole system, because you have to talk, you have to listen. What's the other person saying? What are they feeling? What did they experience? And I'm not just talking about the offender listening to the victim. I'm also talking about the victim listening to the offender, right? Because we got to find out, like, how did we get here? And that was the thing I said to, my former brother-in-law was, like, tell me what I don't know. in terms of your family history. Like we'd had a couple parole hearings at that point. So I knew some things about his upbringing. You know, my sister had shared with me some things while she was alive that I knew about him and his upbringing. Because it's like, how do you get to be a man who's willing to plot the murder and carry out the murder of your wife and your twin 13-month-old sons? Like, how the frick do you get there?
Yeah.
So I'd offered him that opportunity to tell me, like, what I haven't heard at board hearings. You know, what else is there that you haven't spoken about? Just to give me a little understanding for how this happens, because it's unfathomable. So, you know, for victims too, I think sometimes, like, I've heard cases of, you know, someone that was raped by a stranger, which is less common, but, you know, a woman confronted her rapist and said, like, I need to know why you picked me. You know, why us? Another couple that their home was broken into and they came home while that was happening. And then there was a physical altercation with the robber, you know, and he said, why did you pick our house? Because, you know, again, the man, like, lived afraid after that. He felt like he'd failed his family because he didn't keep everything safe. And so, and in both those cases, they basically said, like, it was random. You didn't do anything. It just, you were the place at the time. And the robber said, look, I had a drug addiction. I needed money. And your house was there. And I went in and stole. Yep. You didn't do anything, you know? So having to address those factors and having to listen to each other is really beneficial. It, again, it's not saying that what happened is okay, but it's an understanding of how we got here. And there can be such a peace with understanding. It's really helpful.
Yeah, and particularly when you take a look at so many individuals who experience guilt over circumstances beyond their control, they'll question, what could I have done differently? What could I have done to make my family safer? In the case with my daughter, it was like, why didn't I see the signs of her cancer sooner? Could I have gotten her into a clinical trial sooner? Could we have addressed this sooner? And, you know, with work down the road, I was able to let myself off the hook and realize that I did the best that I could given the circumstances that were presented to me. But I think understanding, why did you pick me? Why did you pick my house to burglarize? Why did you pick my family to victimize? I think they realize that, hey, it wasn't me. It was the choices that person made that contributed to that. It was nothing that I did. And that to me would be incredibly healing, would be incredibly just cathartic.
Yeah, it's huge. And then where do we go from here? You know, mm-hmm. I have a friend, his name is Jacob Dunn, and he's written a book, Right from Wrong, about his experience, because he grew up, you know, same, like, very unhealthy, dysfunctional family. So he experienced a lot of things. And then as a young man was kind of a fighter. That's what he did. That's what his social group did, was they just fought. And so there was one night he came into this pub. His friends had called and said, hey, like, we're going to fight. Come down. And he came down. And without a word, he punched a young man and killed him with one punch. And Jacob didn't know in that moment per se, but he knew something was different. He said, I've never felt the way it felt to punch him. And he ran immediately. And then someone turned him in, a friend of his, because the police were looking for who did this, because the young man did go to the hospital and pass away. And so someone turned in Jacob. So Jacob went, he pled guilty. So again, there's no trial. So the family doesn't get to hear answers or ask questions or anything. And then Jacob was sentenced to 13 months, which to them, the loss of this amazing, promising young man who was training to be like an ambulance attendant, 13 months is nothing. And so they're just left with such grief and loss and emptiness. And so towards the end of Jacob's sentence, they initiated a restorative justice process. And the person that they talked to told them, like, look, like, he's going to be free. He has no reason and incentive to meet with you. So don't be surprised if he says no. Like, there just isn't a motivation for him. And yet they did approach Jacob, and Jacob said yes. He felt like that he would answer some questions for them. And so they started with a letter writing process. It was, you know, it's not always a circle process, at least for sure not at the start. And so for them, they just wrote letters back and forth, you know, through the intermediary. So everything was safe. And, you know, there's confidentiality and privacy for both parties. And so the family just started asking questions. Do you have martial arts training? Did our son spill his pint on you? Because they're in England, so it was a pint.
Yep.
And what happened? And so Jacob was able to reflect, because the whole time that he'd been in prison, he just got angrier And he was going to get out. He was going to find the guy that ratted him out, and he was going to make him pay. That's all Joseph thought, or Jacob thought about. He says, like, I came out worse than when I went in, but not for this restorative justice process. He said, I would have caused more harm. But that opportunity for him to think through what he did and why did he do what he did, because the family needed those answers. And in order for him to get those answers, he had to deal with what he did and he had to face it. And so they kind of said to him, like, well, what are you going to do now? Because a big thing for victims is stop the harm. We yep. can't go back. We all know that. You can't take back what happened, but I want it stopped. I don't want you to hurt anyone else. And so he was like, well, I think I need to graduate high school. I haven't done that. And they said, great. Well, why don't you graduate high school? And maybe then we can meet. You know, and it gave him a goal. It gave him something to work towards. And so that's what he did. He graduated high school and then they met in a circle together. And it's kind of grown and developed from there. And they've gone on to speak in different places together as a, you know, to talk about restorative justice and what that looked like for both of them. There's now a play called The Punch. It's been in England. It's in New York this fall. It's very exciting. And I'm going to try to get it to California just to tell this incredible story of how it changed Jacob's life and stopped further harm, because he self-admits he would have gone on to harm more people. But that reflection of what I did and how it's hurt others, and why did I get here? What contributed to me being here? My own undealt with trauma, you know, poverty cycles, toxic masculinity. I got to prove myself. You know, I work with a nonprofit right now, Sharp Circle. Chris Johnson and I started that 2.5 years ago here in California. We're working in juvenile facilities in San Francisco, Monterey. We're looking to expand. Because Chris was sentenced to 65 years to life for a series of armed robberies that he committed. And he got out after 15 years because of the work that he did on himself and addressing his crime factors. And a big one was that I got to prove myself. He had a girlfriend at the time that he felt he needed to impress. He needed money. He needed the showy life. You know, she liked the signs of violence. So he did all this stuff to prove himself as a man. And then he had to go to jail. And he said when he was prosecuted and seeing the people come up, you know, and read their victim statements and stuff. And he was like, oh my gosh, like these are real people that I robbed. These are real people that I harmed, because he had objectified them and dehumanized them. They were just there for his purposes. But now they're real people that he's made afraid, you know, that he's impacted their lives. And so he went into the prison and he started doing the work. And so now he's working with these young people and trying to help them with where they're at to address these factors. How did we get here? So that we can stop the harm, stop these cycles. And we can't do that without addressing the factors.
Well, and the other thing too, when you're working with young adults, they're coming in with their own generational trauma that breaks the cycle. If you can work with them to say, how do we get here? What can we do to change it? That automatically breaks that cycle and kind of rewrites their family history without rewriting their genetic code.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because it does. It cycles through. Like I can see the harm that I suffered at the hands of my parents, who I think still kind of did try in their own ways to do the best they could. But there was still significant harm, you know, that came from them. And I can see the lineage of that. Right. And I know, like, I haven't been the best parent to my kids either. And especially I have 4 children and I talk about this. My 2 older ones, I feel like they got the worst of me because I learned, you know, because I saw my parents coming out in them and I was like, oh my gosh, but I don't know how to stop it. Like I have to address it because it's just your natural instincts, because it's what you know, it's what you've learned and been taught. So you have to fight against that. So I had to go to therapy, like parenting therapy. I had to, you know, learn from people who were good parents and be like, well, how do you do this? And how do you do that? And so I had to work that all through my older 2. So we always laugh that my younger 2 got the better parent, you know, because I'd learned so much by the time it came to them. So still by far, not a perfect parent whatsoever, but my children are amazing people, despite all of the things that we've all gone through together. So that's a testament, you know, like even if I can lessen the cycles, like I think there's some things that I haven't been able to fully stop because I wasn't able to heal, you know, before I had them. But we're at a place though that they're doing better. And I used to tell my kids, like, I want you to be better than me. my poor daughter, it almost traumatized her because she felt like she had this huge standard to live up to because she kind of looked up to me. And I said, no, but like, look at you right now. Like, my daughter's 19 years old. And the person that she is, the confidence level that she has at her age, the things that she's doing, the way she's using her voice, her advocacy, her desire and passion to help others. I said, you don't understand. You've already outdone me. You're just 19. Like, you're going to keep getting better. Like, you're me, but you're you, but like version 2.0, you're taking all the best things about me and incorporating them with who you are as a person. And that's the best that I could ask for, you know?
Yeah. But you've modeled that for her too. You've modeled that for the rest of your kids. They're seeing advocacy in action with you. They're seeing, you know, what the benefits of restorative justice for you personally, and how you going out as a surrogate and helping others create that community where restorative justice can grow and be an option for healing and for justice, healing justice.
Right. They were also my guinea pigs too. I need to say that, like, when I learned about restorative justice and the whole concepts, you know, because I used to do the, like, okay, timeouts and this and that, you know, and whatever. But as I learned about restorative justice, I went, oh, like, this, it's not just about crime, right? It's really literally about conflict of any kind. Yep. And so they were the first guinea pigs, because I would be like, hey, we're going to family circle. We're going to talk about this. And I used to take those principles and break it down with them. And they'd be like, okay, what happened right now? And how are we feeling about this? And what are we going to do about it? How are we going to go forward? So, I mean, they had circle after circle. And then we got to a point, though, where we started to circle, and they'd be like, okay, what happened now, Mom? What do we got to address? And I'd be like, no, actually, this is just a family circle. And sometimes I would do them just as check-ins and just be like, I just feel like we just need to check in with each other. Or it might be a family circle just for something fun. You know, I'd be like, just tell me the best part of your day today, or whatever it was. But it's a connection point, whether it's to address conflict or whether it's just to reconnect. So we got to a place where circling wasn't looked at as like, oh, no, something's happened. But all of my practices, anyone that I connect with has all benefited because of my children, because they were the guinea pigs.
Well, obviously, they learned whatever you modeled very well, and they're incorporating that. And so give yourself a pat on the back for that one.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Now, let's shift gears for a minute. We got to talk about your book, because Becoming the Brave One, My Journey to Justice, my understanding is that it's going to be released on August 26th. Am I correct?
So that's our official launch day. We've been in, there were pre-sales, but we got it out anyway because the books came. So they've been going out, and the feedback's been pretty amazing, actually. When you write a book, you're like, okay, I hope it's good. And then there's people that, you know, are going to read it and say it's good, but not to discount their opinion, but you're like, well, but you're my friend or whatever, you know? And so when other people read it and say, oh, this impacted me. And so I'm starting, you know, that's starting to happen. I'm starting to get people that are reaching out to me and messaging me and going, this really impacted me. This struck me, or, you know, I'm finding myself in your story. That right there is a critical piece for me. Like, that's why I published it. I wrote the book for me. It was a healing piece for me to write. I published for my audience. I published for them because I've found myself in other people's stories, and I hope that people can find themselves in mine too.
Yeah, it's a very impactful, very powerful story. It's 208 pages, but it's just like from the beginning, it grabbed your attention. The first three lines on page 90 of your book got my attention really quickly with your take about adverse childhood experiences, and I'll just leave that right there for the audience and let them delve into that. But that got my attention. And also, what was particularly moving for me was the conversation with the restorative justice piece that you did with your brother-in-law, and also when your sister was so suddenly taken from you, given the fact that I've had my own catastrophic losses with a family member who died way too young. That resonated with me, and it just, you know, I was kind of with you in the trenches when I was reading when you found out about her death, and in the aftermath, that impacted me tremendously. So it's a great read. I think it's also a testament to the healing power of restorative justice, why it is a better alternative than some of the traditional rehabilitation techniques that the criminal justice system espouses. It's just a great book. I would highly recommend my audience pick it up, read it, reread it, and tell the world about it. So, well, geez, one of my last questions for you, we can go on, I think, probably for another couple hours or so, but for me, and this has been a great conversation, and so thank you for what you have shared with our audience. If you got to leave us with one ultimate takeaway today, one thing that you want the audience to leave with today, what would that be, Amanda?
I think it would be my definition of bravery. It's doing what you know like you need to do or what is right to do, even if you don't feel sufficient. You know, and it's not necessarily big things. It can also just be the little things. Some days bravery might just be getting out of bed, depending on where you are. Or sometimes bravery might be sitting in the room with a man that took everything from you.
Yeah.
It could be any of those things and in between, but you can be brave. It's super hard, but you can be brave and it's worth it and you're worth it.
I like that. Bravery can come in just any form. It doesn't have to be the most heroic act. It can be just the most heroic act for us, given where we're at in our cycle of trauma recovery. So thank you for that. My last question for you, and for those of you, by the way, who are going to watch us on YouTube, Amanda's book is in the background, but I'm going to flash it one more time. I better watch how I use the term flash. I might get some blowback on that, but we're flashing the book and nothing else, folks. Becoming the Brave One, My Journey to Justice. Tell our audience how they can purchase the book, how they can get in touch with you, request any, you know, information on restorative justices, request your services as a surrogate. What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so I'll tell them that while you do a favor for me. Can you flip the book around and show the very back and the bottom of the book? Yeah, right down there. There you go, right there. So if you go to my website, amandacarrasco.com, you can purchase the book there. You can also contact me. But I want you to know, too, 50% of the proceeds of this book goes to Love Does Mexico. My friend Bob Goff is a best-selling author. He helped me through this process, and he said, you know, you got to write your story. So he's been my guide along the way, because it's a hard thing to write a book and get it published and get it out there. And he's an incredible man who started Love Does and the work that he does around the world to help other people in all kinds of really, really crazy and difficult situations. So again, like, this story isn't just about me or for me, it's for others. So yeah, I want to just highlight, you know, Love Does and the work they do around the world. And I specifically chose Mexico because I have family in Mexico, and what they do there actually works with people looking for asylum. So, you know, they're essentially like assisting refugees from around the world. So it has a global impact, even though it's based in Mexico. So I loved that because I've been able to travel around the world a lot and experience incredible, you know, adventures and cultures and people. So, AmandaCarrasco.com is the best way. You can find me on the socials, you know, Amanda the Brave One. And yeah, you can purchase the book from the website. Reach out to me if you have questions, if you need anything. Also, in the back of the book, there's a list of a lot of restorative justice organizations and options. So that's possible if you've been a victim of harm and you are interested to know more or want to have a process. You know, you can reach out to me directly and personally, or you can reach out to some of those organizations. It's exactly what they're there for and what they do. So there's a lot of options. I might be able to help you or point you in the right direction, but, you know, please message me. There's a place that you can go if you want to, you know, get in contact with me, and we can connect on whatever ways it is that I can help you, support you, or guide you, because I have needed that. So if I can be that conduit for others too, then that's perfect.
Thank you. I can put the book.
You can put it down now. Yeah.
I can put it down. Thanks.
You can put it down now. No more flashing.
Oh, jeez. You took all the
Take
fun.
Away all the fun.
Yeah. Take all the way all the fun out of it. No. Amanda, jeez. Anyway, Amanda, thank you so much for just a great conversation today. It was a joy spending time with you, and I hope we can do, I know we're going to do this again in the future, but I hope we can do this again for a follow-up, because there's so much we can talk about with restorative justice and just everything else that you've been through. So hopefully we can do a follow-up in the future.
No, I would love to. That would be great. Thank you for the platform to be able to share the message and the work that you do with your students and just in people's lives around you.
Likewise. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.